morning. It's always a good morning when you got a three-day weekend coming up, right? So, darn, you know, it's terrible. You'll be here knocking on the doors trying to get into the rooms on Monday and think, how come nobody else is here? If you do that, just remember that it's a holiday. And so there are other things going on for Martin Luther King Jr. Day. So, that's coming up. Don't forget that there's a class assignment that's due tomorrow by 1:30. And a lot of you have already returned that. It's about an interesting topic. Think back. You know, what's that all about? Is there such a thing? If so, what are the implications of it and whatnot? So, something that probably most of you haven't heard about before, I'm thinking, but it's out there. And kind of interesting. So anyway, that's due Friday. For those of you that are in my two labs only, okay, the rest of you can ignore this announcement. Because we managed in the first lab to not collect the class data for the trolls, okay, and because I just made an arbitrary decision in the second lab, when you do your graph for the amylase experiment, you do not need to include the two data points for the controls. Those two data points for the controls can be stinkers to get to actually plot on a graph like that. For the rest of you that are in Erica's lab, if you have trouble, I assume she'll have you do that, if you have trouble actually getting the line to connect between the two, there's information at the back of the lab manual that talks about graphing that will give you some hints as to how to do that. That information is geared mostly for the Mac, but I think the section on how to connect dots when you have a free data set gives you the information for the PC also. Although, that's for the last version of Excel, not the current version of Excel. So, to get it to really do what you want it to do, you may have to go into the help command and search for the term. You'll see the term in the instructions. And it's just as simple. It's just one box that you have to check in the preferences, and then that'll connect that line, but you've got to have that box checked. So, anyway, I'd be glad to help you with that if you need help. I'm sure Erica would too. Question? For mine, just the data. Experimental data, not the controls. Right. Okay, so that's a little bit of excitement there, too. There's always one more thing I'm going to tell you, and I never remember where that one more thing is. So let's move on then. So we've been talking about the digestive system, right? And so last time we looked at kind of that cutaway view of the entire digestive system, and remember I promised you that a diagram like that would be on the first midterm. So familiarize yourself, know what all the different structures related to the digestive system look like, where they are, what they're doing, and so forth, and that will help you tremendously on that part of the exam. We took a quick look kind of at those structures, right, and then we began taking a little bit more in-depth look at what was going on. Talked about the cross-sectional structure of the digestive tract, and how, remember, the organs are put together from tissues, and we looked at those different layers that were there. So you got that diagram in your lecture note packet also. And then we continued talking about the structures and so forth. Getting around to the processing. Oh, one thing I wanted to say about the tube within a tube idea that I talked with you about last time, the one thing that I failed to mention is the fact that this tube is open on both ends, and it provides a wonderful microhabitat for all kinds of different organisms to live within. So you have all sorts of things living within your digestive tract, okay? Which is really, in a way, an external environment, because it's continuous with the external environment on both ends. So lots of things can get in. We managed to move lots of things out. Lots of things are making their home in there. Lots of bacteria, lots of different kinds of bacteria. And you think about bacteria usually in a kind of a negative context. But let me tell you, there are bacteria that are really, really helpful. I'll mention in a little while some bacteria that actually produce vitamins for us. And it's great to have them. We'll absorb those vitamins. That's one of our sources of vitamins, is bacteria in the gut. But there are other things that there's certainly harmful bacteria that might be growing in there also that could cause harm. It's an entryway for all sorts of wonderful things like various kinds of parasites. So if you're eating food that isn't properly prepared, that is contaminated with parasite eggs of one type or another, maybe there are worm eggs or there are other kinds of things, they can get entry into the digestive tract that way. If they survive the acid bath in the stomach, then they'll hatch, and there are lots of eggs and spores and things like that really that are designed to survive the acid bath, and they'll hatch and germinate, and so, and they can create problems too. So it's a real mix. But people now are beginning to recognize more and more the value of all the different bacteria that we have living in our digestive tract, and how certain illnesses occur because we might be deficient in certain of the bacteria, or maybe we're overgrown in certain of the bacteria and so forth. So this is a big field that's starting to open up now, when people they're really looking at the ecology of what's going on in the digestive tract and what all the different bacteria are. They're DNA sequencing them. They're trying to figure out what all the bacteria are there and what their functions are. So I think we're going to see in the next few years, we're going to see some real positive results from that in terms of certain kinds of disease control and so forth that we never would have thought about before. So lots of things growing in that digestive tract, in that tube within the tube, right? Okay, so we got that going on. And again, looking at the processing of the food, and I've broken it up a little bit differently here now. So there's mechanical processing that's going on. We're going to continue talking about this today. Mechanical, we talked about chewing, increasing the surface area and so forth. And in the stomach, of course, that stomach is churning, and that mixing is really important. In the stomach, one of the big things is to solubilize all that food that you've taken in as best as possible, and the churning of the stomach is important to do that. So mechanical processing, we talked about chemical processing, though I didn't use those terms necessarily last time. So when we think about chemical processing, there's both non-enzymatic and enzymatic processing that goes on. Right, so we talked about some of the non-enzymatic saliva, liquefaction of the food and so forth, again, really, really important. In the stomach, we talked about the hydrochloric acid and some of the things that the hydrochloric acid is doing. In terms of processing, we've got the number one there, the softening of tissues and breaking down the plant cell walls, the non-specific digestion that goes on. And then as a bonus, death to bacteria and so forth, a lot of things that are in food get killed that way. And then the fourth one, this idea of solubilizing minerals so that they can actually be absorbed and not just pass on through the system. So that's just non-enzymatic processing that's going on in the stomach. And then we talked about the gallbladder too, and how it stores bile. The bile has come from the liver. The liver emulsifies the fat. Right now in lab, you've all been to lab now, and you've seen the effect of that. Hopefully you saw that in amongst those tubes, the tube that had the enzyme and the gall and the bile salts, that reaction went typically a whole lot faster than the reaction that didn't have the bile salts but just had the enzyme. Now that reaction goes fast, don't get me wrong, but typically when you add the bile salts, it goes so much faster. Sometimes it's almost hard to see. You've got to be watching it, and that change occurs over a 5 or 10 minute period really, really quickly. So by emulsifying the fat droplets, by breaking them up into much smaller droplets, it provides more surface area for the enzyme. The enzymes can then break the fats down much more efficiently. That's non-enzymatic processing, just the emulsification of fats that the bile does. And then we talked about enzymes, right? We reviewed enzymes real quickly from last term, and we talked about some of the enzymes We've got more enzymes to talk about today, and believe me, we're not even scratching the surface of enzymes when it comes to talking about enzymes, but just a few enzymes to give you a taste for how the process is going on. So in the mouth, we saw that there were two in the saliva. There was the amylase, which begins to break the starch down into maltose, those disaccharides, two glucose units connected together. And there's also the lipase, which is involved in starting to break down the triglycerides that might be in the meal that you've eaten. And the lipase, remember, releases two of those fatty acids, and you wind up with a couple fatty acids and a monoglyceride. And that was the reaction that you followed in lab this week, too, when you were watching and following the breakdown of the fats, right? You used that pH indicator. The solution started off alkaline, but as those fatty acids, more and more fatty acids were released, they turned the solution acidic, so you went from blue to yellow with our indicator. So that was in the mouth, and of course we talked about how once those enzymes hit the stomach, they're deactivated because the pH is so different. pH in our body in general is slightly alkaline. That's where things work best, but the stomach is highly, highly acidic. So when those enzymes hit the stomach, they're going to be deactivated much, much too low of a pH. They'll get digested just like any other protein you might have in your meal. We saw that in the stomach there's this enzyme, pepsin, that is created by the mucosa of the stomach and released into the contents of the stomach. And that begins the digestion of proteins. Pepsin breaks down protein, identifies certain amino acids, and when it finds those, it'll cut that larger protein in those places. So we start breaking that protein down into smaller pieces. And we'll continue doing that with other enzymes later on. Okay, so that's what we've talked about so far. Now we've got this really acidic mass of food now that needs to move on, needs to move to the next area. As that food gets really solubilized and so forth, then the pyloric sphincter at the other end of the stomach is going to start relaxing, and because of the churning, that food's going to start squirting into the small intestine. I think sometimes people have this impression that valve's going to open all the way, well, everything's going to go into the small intestine at once, and it doesn't do that. Okay, it happens over a period of time as that food is being liquefied over a period of time. So small batches of the food at a time getting squirted into the small intestine. Now we have a problem with that, and the problem is this stuff is highly acidic. And the small intestine isn't designed for a highly acidic food to get in there. Now remember, the stomach, one of the fluids that are released in the stomach is mucus that coats the surface of the cells and protects them from the acidity and protects them from the pepsin too. We don't have that in the small intestine. So the first thing that we need to do as that food's starting to get squirted in the small intestine, we need to neutralize the pH. And we get alkaline solutions from a couple of different sources that are going to go ahead and help to neutralize that pH, bring the pH up to a slightly alkaline level from where it's at. So one of those things are pancreatic juices. Which on its own has a pH of about 7.8 to 8. So that's going to interact with this highly acidic mass from the stomach and neutralize that and bring it up to a slightly alkaline pH. Okay, so that's one source. And the other source is going to be bile. Bile is also an alkaline fluid. We talked about bile produced in the liver, stored in the gallbladder. That will flow into the small intestine also to help neutralize that. The first little region of the small intestine is really critical for these because the ducts coming from the pancreas, the duct coming from the gallbladder and so forth, all empty into that first little region that we call the duodenum. That's about the first 12 inches or so of the small intestine. critically important because of those ducts feeding in and so forth, so that we can get those pancreatic fluids, we can get the bile and so forth from the gallbladder. So this helps these fluids flowing in and mixing with that mass from the stomach neutralizes that mass. So now we're back up to a slightly alkaline pH, and that's where everything else is going to be operating at. All the rest of the enzymes and so forth work best at a slightly alkaline pH. So we're in the small intestine now. We've got these things flowing in. What are some of the enzymes that we see that are going to help to break these things down? And we're actually going to get the enzymes from a couple of different sources. So they're going to come from the pancreas. The pancreas is basically an enzyme factory. And we've talked about this before. The pancreatin that you used in lab this week, remember, it's got the two enzymes in it that we were interested in, the amylase and the lipase, but it's got just a bunch of other enzymes in there too. So we're adding all these enzymes to the mix to help us to digest our food. Pancreas, about 97% of pancreas tissue, if you were to look at it, it's enzyme production. That's what it's doing. The other 3% we'll talk about later. The other source of the enzymes is the mucosal cells themselves. So those are the cells lining the small intestine, right? Lining the inside of the duodenum. And they're going to produce enzymes that are either going to be added to the fluid inside, added to the mixture of everything that's going on in the small intestine, or those enzymes are going to be bound in the outer membranes of those cells. And as they do their reactions, then the results of those reactions, what we're trying to do is break our food down into individual subunits. So those individual subunits will just actually move into the cells. They'll be absorbed into the cells and move on. And so I'll save that for a few minutes when we talk about absorption of nutrients. Okay, so these are basically our two sources of enzymes, and for the dozens of enzymes that are involved. Now let's talk about pancreatic enzymes first. And then I'll talk just a little bit about some of these mucosal enzymes, and especially ones that are attached to the membranes of the cells. So from the pancreas, one enzyme that we're going to find is one called trypsin. Trypsin. That's obviously one of those enzymes that was named a long time ago because it doesn't follow the rules. Okay, trypsin. It doesn't end in an ASE or anything like that, but it's a very well-known and studied enzyme. And trypsin continues the breakdown of protein. So it started with pepsin in the stomach. Once we get into the small intestine, because we raise the pH, that pepsin's no longer effective. Okay, it's designed to be used in a very acidic, like pH 2 environment. We're up to about maybe pH 7.1, 7.2 in the small intestine. Well, that's not going to be working, but we have other enzymes. So we get this trypsin from the pancreas, and it's going to also break down these shorter pieces of the protein. Now remember, the pepsin was just breaking the protein into smaller pieces based on where it found certain amino acids in the protein. So you get a whole range of sizes of pieces depending on what the amino acid composition is. Trypsin's going to do the same thing, but it's going to identify different amino acids. Okay, so now we're breaking it down. We're identifying another set of amino acids that the trypsin will bind to, and every time it finds one of those, it's going to cut that protein chain at that point. It's going to cleave that peptide bond. And so we're getting progressively smaller and smaller pieces of our protein as a result of first the pepsin processing and now the trypsin processing. There are other enzymes that will come into play. And ultimately, we're going to get that protein broken down into its individual amino acids. And it's those individual amino acids that we can absorb efficiently into the body. So that's the goal, is to get it broken down into the amino acids so that we can absorb them. We're not going to worry about the names of other enzymes that might be involved here. So one enzyme from the pancreas is trypsin. Second enzyme from the pancreas is amylase. And because it's coming from the pancreas, we would call this pancreatic amylase. The amylase we had in the saliva, we would call salivary amylase, just to distinguish the point of origin of these two different enzymes. So pancreatic.
Is there a difference between the two?
Now, I was heading there. There's no difference between the two. We have genes that code for the enzyme amylase, and that enzyme is made in two locations, the salivary glands and the pancreas. That's where those genes are activated in order to do that. So there's really no difference between the two, but sometimes it depends on what you're doing. Like, for example, that experiment that we did in lab this week where we used the pancreatin, if you'd have been in this class a few years ago, we used to, rather than using pancreatic amylase, we used salivary amylase. And we collected that salivary amylase by having people collect saliva. You get the same reaction, okay? But it was a little more interesting in those days because every so often, we'd get no reaction. We'd find a person who's not producing amylase in their saliva. And we'd wind up with no reaction. So that was kind of fun. But we decided that spitting into a test tube was probably old school and so forth, so now we use the pancreatin to do that with. So, obviously we're going to continue the breakdown of starch. We're going to continue breaking those very, very large polymers of glucose down into the little dipeptides, the maltose. Now, amylase will not take it any farther than that. We cannot absorb maltose. Okay, we cannot absorb the dipeptides, the disaccharides. We need that further broken down into the monosaccharides. So let me come back to that in a minute. That particular enzyme is not a pancreatic enzyme. It's an enzyme that's coming from the mucosal cells. So since we're talking about pancreas right now, let's come back to that. So amylase, another enzyme we're going to get from the pancreas, is one that you're very familiar with now, lipase. So to replace that lipase that was in the saliva that got destroyed once it went through the stomach, we're going to put more lipase into the mix. So that's going to continue breaking our triglycerides down into the fatty acids and the monoglycerides. Okay, so we got that going again, and lots of other enzymes from the pancreas that we are not going to talk about. Now, okay, so now let's talk about the mucosal cells. And these three enzymes that I'm going to talk with you about actually are those that I mentioned earlier that would be actually bound into the membrane of the mucosal cells. And they're showing at that outer surface. Okay, so you've got all this food moving through. The outer surface of the mucosal cells are being bathed in this fluid that has all sorts of different things in it. And these cells have enzymes bound into their cell membrane. What kind of tissue are these cells? Lining the surface? Epithelial cells, right. So this is a type, and in fact, they were the columnar epithelial cells like you looked at in lab, only you had, those weren't from a human source. Okay, so these are epithelial cells that have these enzymes built into their membranes. And as they then undergo these reactions that I'm going to talk about, the disaccharides are going to be on the outside in the mix that's moving through, but then as they complete the reaction, they're going to be moving the monosaccharides that they're creating into the epithelial cells and moving them on through, absorbing into the body, and I'll come back to that in a minute. So, three enzymes that I would like to point out to you, all of them dealing with disaccharides. Again, we cannot absorb disaccharides. So, What are they? We've talked about maltose. So the enzyme that breaks maltose down into its individual glucose units is called maltase. Okay, it's obeying the rules. So maltase, if we take maltose, so that's a glucose connected to glucose. In the presence of maltase, we wind up with 2 glucose. And we certainly can absorb the glucose. So we've gotten to where we wanted to get here now. And we can absorb that glucose into our bodies. We get it into the blood. In fact, when we talk about blood sugar, what we're talking about is glucose flowing through the blood. You know, how much glucose is there in the blood? And we'll be coming back to that later on. So, maltase is one enzyme. Another common disaccharide that we find in our diets is sucrose. All right, sucrose, table sugar. Right, lots of sucrose getting used for a variety of things. Sucrose is also a disaccharide, and we have an enzyme called sucrase that will break the sucrose down. So that's another one. So that's going to take sucrose, which is a combination of a glucose and a fructose. Those two are both, they're 6-carbon sugars. They're very, very closely related to each other. There's just some subtle differences between the two. But the sucrase will break this down into a glucose plus a fructose. And we can, again, we can absorb both of those into our body. So it's going to be, as that membrane's bound into the, as the enzyme's bound to the membrane, the glucose and the fructose are going to wind up on the inside of the cell. They're going to move on and get absorbed into the blood. Okay, so we've managed to break down our sucrose now, second enzyme. Third enzyme that we find in this situation is one called lactase. What sugar do you think lactase will break down? Lactose. Okay. So lactose, which is a combination of glucose and another very, very, very closely related sugar called galactose. So lactose in the presence of lactase gets broken down into that glucose plus galactose. Now, let's look back. Okay, so the maltose we find primarily from the breakdown of starches. Yeah, question. Plenty of choices, 18 options. Well, maybe not quite that many. Okay, so maltose breakdown of starch, and you know, generally we've got starch in our diet, so we're breaking this down and absorbing that. Sucrase, breakdown of that sucrose, and certainly in our modern day diets, we've got plenty of sucrose in the diet, and so we're breaking that down. Where's the most common source of lactose? Milk products, right? You hear about people that are lactose intolerant. Okay, people, what that means is that they're either not making any or not making enough lactase. And if we don't get that lactose broken down, it's not going to get absorbed. It's going to pass from the small intestine into the large intestine as the disaccharide. You've got plenty of bacteria in the large intestine that will thank you profusely for feeding them. And they'll utilize that lactose. They'll absorb it in and utilize it to meet their energy needs. But the downside is that they're pretty much anaerobic, not a lot of oxygen in the large intestine. And so the kind of metabolism that they're doing tends to produce a variety of gases and things like that. So people who are lactose intolerant have this problem. After they've eaten a milk product, they've gotten the lactose in, they haven't digested it down. And then all of a sudden, they're getting this gassiness, these other complications that people who are lactose intolerant wind up with. And it's simply because they're not producing lactase, and they're not breaking that, the glucose and the lactose apart so they can absorb them into the body. So the bacteria are taking care of it for you. If you do you can do studies, and it's interesting, different populations of different origins have different abilities to produce lactose. Now, most babies will produce lactose, and you find lactose in mother's milk, okay? But then as they grow up, what happens? And generally, the populations that will continue to produce the lactose on into adulthood and old age are populations that originate from areas, as you might expect, that have a lot of cows, that eat a lot of milk products and so forth, and they will continue, they tend to continue to metabolize, to produce the lactose and metabolize those things. Populations that really don't have access to much of that, they oftentimes are the ones that will, why make the lactase if you're not using it? And they'll quit making it, and so if they're in a situation where they get a hold of it, then they have these problems. Yeah. Lactose intolerance certainly can be genetic. And this whole idea of how does your genetic expression change over time as you mature, as you age, and so forth, where you're producing something at one point in time, producing say enzymes early on, different physiological things going on as you age may cause you to quit producing them, or may cause you to start producing other things.
That's part of the aging process.
But yeah, lactose intolerance tends to be
genetic. I was reading about food allergies, and is it true that if you run out of enzymes and adjust a certain type of food, then your body will absorb some part of the undigested food, and that could develop food allergies?
Okay, so your question is, is there like food allergies? Run out of enzymes while you're digesting food.
If you like, say you eat too much of one type of food in your body, it's producing enzymes to digest all of it, or something like that. Is that possible?
So you run out of enzymes because you ate, and so that undigested food in your body then becomes sensitized to that undigested food. That's true.
Yeah, is that correct? I was reading that.
Okay, I'm not talking about food allergies. Problem that I see with that idea, and that is that when allergies develop, you really need to get that into your body and into your bloodstream, probably or something like that. Although I suppose some reactions could happen on the surface because there are sensitivities to the contact. I suppose I could imagine a situation where, I mean, allergies generally are to proteins. So I imagine a situation perhaps where if you didn't thoroughly and efficiently digest your protein, your body would sensitize to it. But what do they say is the solution to take an enzyme?
To eat smaller portions of.
Well, that's always a good idea.
Yeah, just like your body can digest a certain amount of things. Protein.
I tend to be cynical about certain things. I would really like to see the
video.
Yeah, but I'd really like to see the video about that. See, because I think if you were constantly overloading your system, I think your system would respond by probably producing more of the enzyme. So I'd love to see the video on that. That is an interesting idea, but I honestly, I don't know. I don't know if anybody else heard about this sort of thing where overeating causes food allergy basically. Interesting concept.
I'm afraid to say too much about that because it's kind of interesting. Okay, so these are the three enzymes that I wanted to tell you about that are mucosal in origin, and they're all dealing with dipeptides, and we've got to get those broken down to mono dipeptides. Diglyceride. Hello. double sugars. Okay, the term has just, I can think of every other term but that one right now. Disaccharides, we've got to get them broken down to monosaccharides, right, in order to absorb them. Pardon me? Okay, so disaccharide and then mono, we'll just, you know, just replace the di with the mono. So disaccharide is two subunits put together. Now, the only other thing that I want to add in here then would be, and this is liver origin, just to complete our little survey here, would be the bile. So we talked about bile off and on several times. We've seen that the bile doesn't have any enzymatic activity of its own. And you should have seen that in lab this week when you looked at that fourth tube where you had the bile salts, the cream, the bromothymol blue, but you did not add enzyme. I would have expected that tube, whatever color it started off with, probably shaded a little bit different from some of the other tubes because the bile itself is yellow, but I would have expected that tube to not change color over time. And I'm assuming that that's what most or all of you saw. The bile itself doesn't cause the fats to break down. The bile helps to speed up the breakdown of the fats by breaking them down into smaller droplets, which then the enzyme can more efficiently digest. But it's critically important because we tend to have fats in our foods and so forth, and we want to efficiently break those things down. Now, what happens if somebody gets their gallbladder removed? Say, oh no, now they've got no storage of bile. Right? So when they come along to eat, there's nothing, no gallbladder to squeeze, no big injection of bile to help emulsify those fats and so forth. Were you going to answer my question? Is that the liver continues to make bile. And so even during that meal, the liver will continue to make bile. Some bile will flow in, assuming that the duct hasn't been disconnected. But it's not anywhere near as much bile as you would have normally expected. And so it's going to impair your ability to digest fats and create some problems. As long as you control your diet and keep the fat level down, then you're going to be in pretty good shape. Okay, so those are just some examples of the digestive process. And notice I'm going to stop with the small intestine because we really don't have any significant digestion going on in the large intestine. So we'll pick up with the large intestine in a minute when we talk about the absorption of nutrients. But this is pretty much it. By the time we move on out of the small intestine, pretty much everything that's going to get digested has been digested. The story's over there, and we just need to clean things up with the large intestine. Okay, any questions about this before we move on to my next thought about this process? Okay. So the next thing that I've got here in the lecture notes is this idea of control of digestion. And the point is that the digestive process, though you may think it's just kind of automatic, it just happens and so forth, it's under a lot of control. So a lot going on in order to control what's happening here and to make sure that the right things are getting added at the right time and all of that kind of stuff. When we think about control in the body, we think about communication between various one part of the body to another part of the body. And when we think about communication, there are really two different mechanisms by which we communicate internally. One is the nervous system. And the nervous system, we looked at those nerve cells in lab a week ago. The nervous system is designed to very, very rapidly communicate from one point of the body to the next and cause something to happen or not, depending on what we're talking about.
Okay, but it's very, very rapid communication within the body, and it allows us to pinpoint very precise areas in the body to maybe cause something to happen or not. And I have to always include the or not, because we'll see later on that there are some nerves that actually slow things down rather than speeding things up and stuff. So very, very precise. And there's an element of nervous control in the whole digestive process that we'll come back to in a minute. Okay, so there is some nervous input that's involved. The other kind of communication that we find in the body is hormones. Now, hormones are a slower way of communicating. A hormone is a smaller molecule that gets produced in one place in the body. It enters the bloodstream, travels through the bloodstream, and eventually reaches a target somewhere else in the body. So when we talk about hormones, we're talking about these small molecules that are getting produced. The pituitary gland is notorious. It is just a hormone factory. It produces all sorts of different hormones. It's not the only hormone-producing tissue by any means in the body. So these hormones are being produced. They're being released into the blood. They have to circulate around the body until they get to that target organ. It may be fairly direct. It may not be fairly direct. It depends on where everything is in relation to how they're hooked up. So we're going to go through the blood system and eventually target an organ or something to cause an effect. Now, where nerves were really fast and precise, hormones obviously are slower, and they tend to target more general areas. They're not as precise as the nervous system. And their effects tend to be longer lasting, too. The nervous system, the effect tends to be as long as you're getting nervous impulses, and when the nervous impulses stop, that's it. But hormones tend to be around a longer period of time. So some real differences in the way these two communication systems work. There's a very real hormonal component to digestion also. So we're going to be using both of these systems to control digestion. So let's think about it. First of all, the neural. What neural input do we have? There are nerves from the brain feeding down to the stomach. We talked last time. I mentioned, I think, how if you're used to eating at a particular time, your stomach, your body kind of revs up for that in advance. Maybe your stomach starts to growl. You know, what is going on there? Why don't you be quiet? Your stomach's starting to churn. You're starting to get revved up for that meal that it thinks is coming at its normal time. And that's under nervous control. So you have nerves that are starting to get that whole process going, maybe get some gastric fluids going in the stomach so that everything's ready to go. Neural control. Hormonal control kicks in once you get food in the mouth and start chewing food and swallowing food. So let's fill in some blanks here. So when you have food in the mouth or protein in the stomach, okay, so you're chewing food in the mouth, protein in the stomach, we see that the lining of the stomach releases a hormone called gastrin. Now, a couple of these hormones are really kind of interesting in the path that they take. So the gastrin is being released by what we call the gastric mucosa. It's just the lining of the stomach. And it's going to target the lining of the stomach. Okay, so it's come right back and target itself. But as a hormone, it's going to be released. It's going to get in the blood supply. It's going to circulate around the body. And then it's going to come back and it's going to target the lining of the stomach again. So the target is the lining. And what it causes the lining of the stomach to do is to release additional gastric juices. Now, remember we talked last time about gastric juice, gastric fluid, comprised of mucus, that is comprised of hydrochloric acid. It was comprised of pepsinogen, that precursor to the enzyme pepsin that helps to start breaking down the protein. So as we have that food starting to go through the system, now we have a means of increasing the amount of gastric fluids that are in the stomach to help this whole process to occur. As that acidic food mass enters the duodenum, so now we're starting to see it squirt in, we're getting it into the duodenum, it causes the release of the second hormone, secretin. Now secretin, where gastrin originated from the lining of the stomach and targeted the lining of the stomach, secretin is released from the lining of the duodenum. Okay, so the mucosal cells lining the duodenum are going to release the secretin. It's going to find its way again into the bloodstream. But this time it's not going to come back and target itself. It's actually going to go off, and it's got a couple of other targets. One of those targets is the pancreas. And it causes the release of alkaline fluids from the pancreas. Alkaline fluids. So here we've got now these alkaline fluids flowing into the duodenum and helping to neutralize the acidity of that food that's come out of the stomach. Right, so the target causes the release of alkaline fluids, and it also targets the liver to increase bile output. And that's good, because we need the bile. If you've got a gallbladder, you've got a lot of bile anyway, probably. But if you don't have a gallbladder, this is really useful, because it's going to help produce some, get some bile into the system. So the secretin is targeting these two areas, release of alkaline fluids, and increasing bile output. Good things to have happen. Third hormone, and by the way, there are other hormones involved here too, but we're just going to look at these three. So the presence of fats and proteins in the duodenum. Okay, the presence of fats. Now we're moving this food mass into the duodenum, we're neutralizing the pH. Presence of fats and proteins in the duodenum, which are pretty much going to be there about any meal that you eat, releases this third hormone, which has that really long name. How in the world do you say that? Cholecystokinin. And if you could spell it correctly, that would be a bonus. Cholecystokinin. And that's going to target two areas also. So the first thing it will target is the gallbladder. What's it going to cause the gallbladder to do? What would you think? Contract, right? We want to get the bile going in, so it's going to cause that to contract. And it also targets the pancreas, causing it to release fluids that are high in enzyme content. And those enzymes are then going to flow into the duodenum also and add to our enzyme content there and get that all that digestion going, support that digestion and so forth. So, three different hormones, neural input, three different hormones and so forth. It's not a process that just kind of randomly happens because food happens to be flowing down through, right? There's a lot of control over what's going on to ensure that we get as complete a digestion as possible and get the most value out of our food. Now over there on the
top of page 11, I've included the colorectal reflex. Just an interesting little point of information. There's this colorectal reflex that's probably stronger in some people than others. But basically, when you fill your system with food at the top, you get kind of a reflexive, let's empty it from the bottom type thing. So colorectal, so as food's moving along, it stimulates a bowel movement so that you can empty it out at the bottom and be prepared for all this new food that's going to be coming through the system and so forth. So some of you may have noticed it, maybe not, but there is this other aspect of what's going on here too to do with this. Okay, any questions about this? So hormonal control, nervous control, all sorts of things going on. Okay, the next thing to look at would be absorption, but you know, let's take a 5 minute or so break before we get into absorption, and then maybe we'll probably be able to absorb the material better, and we'll get on to it. Okay, let's talk about absorption. So far, we've managed to get our food in, right? We've managed to break it down into manageable pieces. We've managed to digest our food, so we're doing good. We need to now absorb it, because remember, until it gets absorbed, it's really just on its way out. Right? So to make use of it, we've got to absorb it. So how does that all work? Now, keep in mind that we have these epithelial tissues lining all of our surfaces, right? So if we're going to absorb anything, we're going to need to absorb it through the epithelial cells. And then they're going to move it into the blood stream. Primarily, we'll be absorbing things ultimately into the blood. Although, when we talk about some of the larger fats and things, we'll be actually moving those into the lymphatic system. So we'll take a look at that real quick also, at least that idea. So I guess we should start with the mouth. What do we really absorb in the mouth? Well, we don't absorb really a whole lot in the mouth. The food just isn't in the mouth for very long. It's not broken down to the appropriate sizes and so forth. We will absorb some water, and some alcohol can get absorbed through the surfaces of the mouth. But you really don't think of the mouth as being much of an absorptive surface. So not a lot going on there. Stomach. Remember, the mucosa, the inner layer of the stomach, is covered with what? It's covered with the M word. Mucus, right? It's hard to absorb things through mucus. I think people oftentimes think everything happens in the stomach, right? You absorb everything, you digest it, you absorb it, and so forth. There's a little absorption in the stomach, but there tends not to be a lot of absorption in the stomach either. The stomach, as I mentioned last time, is very useful because it allows us to take a meal in, allows us then to walk off and do other things while that meal is becoming liquefied. It's kind of, you think of it in a way as a storage place for food for a while. Liquefaction is one of the big things that goes on in the stomach, and so forth, but not a whole lot of absorption, though some can occur. So that gets us to the small intestine. And the small intestine, there's a tremendous amount of absorption that occurs there. So not only are the digestive processes that we've talked about going on in the small intestine, but as the food moves along, then absorption becomes. So if we were to examine the lining of the small intestine, the mucosa, we'd see that it changes as we progress further down. So the duodenum is going to have a very specialized look to it. We've got the ducts coming in. We've got cells that have certain enzymes bound into their membranes. We're producing other
enzymes that are getting put into the mix in the duodenum. Critically important part. But as we move along beyond that, we see that the surface is going to start to change and it's going to become much more absorptive. Now, the key to absorption is surface area. The more surface area that you have, the more absorption you're going to accomplish. And what we'll see, let's flip over to page 12 there, that diagram. Surface of the small intestine becomes much more folded. But if you examine the folds closely, you see that those folds have little projections coming out of them. So it's kind of, this isn't the best model in the world, but it's kind of like this. If this were the lower down in the small intestine, okay? So on the outside, all you're seeing is this tube, right? But on the inside, actually I don't have the folds, but I've got these little projections. Like what you're seeing here, little projections called villi. Okay, that's plural, a villus, V-I-L-L-U-S would be singular. So there are all these little projections. So what we're doing is we're increasing the surface area that we have over which absorption can occur. Yeah, question?
Is that similar to the surface of our tongue?
Oh, those are, I guess you might think in terms of looking at it, but totally different in terms of what's going on. Yeah. If we take a single, so this diagram takes little sections, right, for you to look at. If we take a single villus and examine it, so that would be one of these little guys that I've got here in my forest of villi, and examine it, we'd see the cellular structure. So the third diagram that you've got there shows a singular villus. Lined with columnar epithelial cells. Okay, there they are. There's more structure to it than this drawing shows. Within the mucosal layer, we'll have capillary beds, so very, very small blood vessels that are feeding in there. And we need to get the nutrients into those capillaries. The one thing that doesn't show on that diagram is a part of the lymphatic system called the lacteal. Be also, I'm going to just draw it in here to the side. Okay, there's a big line vessel that's going to start here. I say it's blind because there's nothing connected to the top. Okay, so it's just a closed sac. And this is going to connect in with the lymphatic system. So well, we'll talk a minute about the absorption of fats and how that they're going to actually get absorbed into this lacteal. Okay, and then if you look closely at these columnar epithelial cells, you see, oh wait a minute, what's that little fuzzy looking thing? Are those cilia? No. We don't have cilia to move things along. Instead, if you look at a close-up of one of these cells, we'll see these further little projections called microvilli. So the villi are these larger projections that we see here, and the microvilli are just kind of like villi on a small scale, except they're coming out on the top of one cell. So if these were the villi in our small intestine, then if this being a one single columnar epithelial cell now, here are all the little microvilli that are on the surface is pointing in. So here's the hollow part, here's where the food's traveling through. And these are creating much more surface area over which absorption can occur. This is where the absorption's happening. Okay, it's on these microvilli. They're fronting into that opening. Now, why go to all that trouble? It's because the more surface area we have, the more efficiently we can absorb things. Now, there are different ways that we can do this. For example, rather than going to all this trouble to having all this fine detail and structure and so forth, why don't we just extend the length of the intestine? Well, the small intestine tends to be about 20 or 21 feet long, something like that. That's what you've got packed in here already. the presence of folds and villi and microvilli increased the surface area by about 600 fold. So you got 600 times the surface area than you would have if you had just a smooth cylinder. So if our small intestine were just a smooth cylinder, how long would it need to be? Well, how long was that? Really long, right? Really long. 600 times 20, about maybe 12,000 feet or something. I wonder where you're going to put that and how you're going to move everything through there. So this is a very efficient system for increasing the surface area so that we can get much, much more absorption going on than if we just had a smooth cylinder. In the small intestine, a little bit beyond the duodenum, in the small intestine is where we get the absorption of all sorts of things. Most nutrients. So absorption of most of our nutrients. Actually, any nutrients that don't get absorbed in the small intestine are not going to get absorbed because the large intestine does not absorb nutrients. Like we've got going through here. So nutrients, most vitamins, that are passing through the small intestine. And that would be both water and fat soluble vitamins. We're going to be absorbing both the water and fat soluble in. Water. It's estimated that somewhere around 78 to 89% of the water that's moving through the system is going to be absorbed in the small intestine. A variety of salts. So a lot of different things. We talk about nutrients, all these different things. These are being absorbed through those microvilli in. And so what will be happening absorbing them into these cells, and then they have to pass through and pass into the space between the cells back here and eventually find their way into the blood supply and then circulated around the body through the blood supply. Now let's talk about just real quickly about the absorption of certain fat-soluble vitamins. Because this kind of relates to that article that you're reading for this week. The absorption of fat-soluble. The absorption of these, and we're talking about things like A, D, E, and K. The absorption of these can be depressed or reduced by a lack of several things. It can be reduced by a lack of pancreatic enzymes. So if you don't have enough pancreatic enzymes, it can affect that absorption. It can be reduced by a lack of absorbable fats. Because these fat-soluble vitamins tend to get absorbed along with the absorbable fats as they're being absorbed into the system. That's where olein really comes into play, because olein, being a fake fat, doesn't get absorbed. And so that will reduce the absorption of fat-soluble vitamins, as well as olein passing through in little droplets and those fat-soluble vitamins dissolving into those little droplets and not getting absorbed. So that it, when it talks about cutting down on the absorption of vitamins, that's what's going on there with that. Lack of that or enough bile. So it's thought that the bile has an influence in the absorption of these things too. Barring those kinds of things going on, then we're absorbing those fat-soluble vitamins okay along the, if you've got problems related to these things, then you probably want to make sure that you're enhancing your intake of the fat-soluble vitamins so that you can get enough into your body. So most things are going to be absorbed this way. Let's talk about the absorption of fats really quick, because they do go by a different means. So absorption of fats. And we are actually at the bottom of page 11 right now. We've been working on page 11 for a little bit. Absorption of fats. So remember, the lipase is breaking the fats, the triglycerides, down into individual fatty acids and monoglycerides. Right? Now, if the fatty acids are small, okay, less than about 10 to 12 carbons long. So that would be a small fatty acid. If they're small, they will get absorbed directly into the cells, into the cells lining the microvilli, and they'll get absorbed and pass through, and they'll get absorbed directly into the blood. So small fatty acids are going to get absorbed directly into the blood, just like everything else is getting absorbed directly into the blood. The difference becomes if the fatty acids are a little bit larger. So if the fatty acids are greater than about 10 to 12 carbons long, then they have a whole interesting different fate. What happens is they'll be absorbed into these epithelial cells, but they'll actually get remanufactured back into triglycerides. So they'll get remanufactured into triglycerides, and then they'll get coated with cholesterol and protein. Okay, so inside the cell, remanufactured, coated with cholesterol and protein. And then they get emptied into the fluid at the back of the cell. So they're emptied in the fluid outside the backs of the cell. So we're space here. We'll talk more about the space later on. I'm not going to throw the term at you right now. So we get emptied into that area back there by exocytosis. So if you remember when we talked about how do we move things into out of cells in Biology 101, exocytosis was one of those processes where we could move big things out of cells, deliver them to the outside. So that's how they're getting delivered. And then they get picked up by the lymphatic system. So here's where they're going to go there. So they get picked up. So rather than going directly into the bloodstream, they'll get picked up by these lacteals. Now the interesting thing is this lymphatic system connects in with the circulatory system. So that provides their entryway. Eventually we're going to find these triglycerides coated by the cholesterol and the protein. We're going to find them in the circulatory system, in the blood itself, because the lymphatic fluids that are flowing through here all connect into the circulatory system. So that's their way of getting into circulation. And if you've had a meal that's high in fat content, say, and if you were able to look at your lymphatic fluids after that, coming from the digestive tract, you see that they're kind of milky because of the amount of fat that's being carried into the system by this mechanism that's going on here. So the bigger fatty acids are picked up that way and move through the lymphatic system. Everything else goes directly into the blood supply. Okay, so we've got the absorption going on in the small intestine. And as I said, nutrients being absorbed. If it doesn't get absorbed here, it's not going to get absorbed. It's on its way out. So that's a lot of work for the small intestine. Next thing, we connect into the large intestine. Okay, so the food will move into the large intestine. We're on page 13 now. And nutrient absorption, usually complete. The mucosal cells of the large intestine lack the proteins in their membrane to allow them to transport these things in. So I've been talking about moving things into the epithelial cells. Well, you've got to have proteins in the membranes that are actually carrying them in. Another thing we talked about in biology 101, they're being carried in by those proteins. Well, the cells in the large intestine lack those specific carriers, and so we can't move those things in anymore. So what goes on in the large intestine? Well, certainly water absorption. So that the large intestine finish up the water absorption. It's estimated that by the time the feces are created and so forth, that at least 98% of the water that has been in the digestive tract has been reabsorbed back into the body. So the fecal pellet tends to be, even though it's got water in it, it doesn't have near the amount of water that it could have had. And of course, if that water absorption is interfered with, you wind up with diarrhea, right? So there are certain things that will do that. So large intestine, we're getting water absorption, also absorbing salts, continuing to absorb salts, certain vitamins. Certain vitamins, and those are vitamins that are coming from bacteria that are living in your large intestine. So I've talked earlier about all these different things that might be living in you. You got these bacteria that are living in the large intestine. And they, one of the things they do for us is they produce things like vitamin B12, thiamin, riboflavin. And vitamin K. So those vitamins that were in the food that you ate, a lot of those would have gotten absorbed in the small intestine, but now we've got these bacteria that are producing more, and we can actually absorb those in the large intestine. So we're getting a lot of things absorbed. At the same time, we're seeing that those remainders that maybe didn't get broken down or digested, those things that didn't get absorbed up in the nutrients that didn't get absorbed in the small intestine and so forth, those are getting dehydrated down. We're finishing up the water absorption, and we're creating that fecal pellet that we need to get rid of. We've got to get rid of all that stuff. We don't want it to accumulate. By the way, it just reminded me, every so often you see these ads that talk about all the tar and goop and gunk that you collect in your colon, right? And so they're trying to sell some sort of cathartic to empty all that out and stuff. And don't think it really happens. They're just trying to make some money off scaring people, thinking you've got 6 pounds you're carrying around that they're just sitting there poisoning you. It could happen in some people, but probably not most of us. We're pretty efficient at getting rid of that material. If you've ever gone in for some sort of an exam that requires you to have an empty digestive tract, endoscopy, something like that, you know how much fun it can be. The day before, you're given a prescription that you go and fill, and that almost immediately produces extreme diarrhea, and you wind up emptying out your digestive tract. Well, what that is generally, at least the older versions of it, were salts like magnesium sulfate. Now, magnesium sulfate doesn't really get absorbed very well. So you drink this fluid that's incredibly, incredibly salty. You kind of gag it down, right? And then what will happen is that the water osmotically will not get absorbed out of the digestive tract. Osmotically, that water is going to follow that salt. And so everything that's flowing through the digestive tract liquefies because the water is not going away. And it really works to clear you out well. That's called a saline cathartic that does that. And it does it because it's very poorly absorbed. So you got all this salt going through. That's why you probably don't want to drink salt water. You know, you don't want to increase the salt content in your body because the salt water, you know, it's going to cause problems like diarrhea and so forth too. So, okay, fecal pellet. So the large intestine is doing some absorption here, but fecal pellet formation is really important. If we were to examine the fecal pellet, now I don't know why people do this, but you know, people are curious. Fecal pellet is about 75% water. Now remember, I told you 98% of the water that's been in the system has been absorbed back into the body. But there's still a little more water left in there, so that your feces are about 75% water and about 25% solids by weight. So that's what you've got going. So what are these solids? What is it that we're trying to get rid of? So certainly undigested foods. Undigested foods, roughage, fiber, those are good things because they help in the formation here, right? But those are things that we can't digest. And so we pass them on through. Unabsorbed nutrients. Okay, nutrients that we haven't been able to absorb. Inorganic materials. Inorganic materials, salts, certain salts like calcium and phosphate that don't get absorbed well into the body necessarily. It's estimated that about 15% of the solids are these kinds of inorganic materials that are passing through the system. Bacteria. So we talked about bacteria earlier, the bacteria especially living in the large intestine. It's estimated that about 30% by weight, or 30% of these solids by weight, is bacteria that we're getting rid of, that have been growing in our gut. Fat and fat derivatives. It's estimated to be about 5% of the solids there, and then you always have to have a category like this, miscellaneous. That would include marbles, pennies for little kids, but also things like shed mucosal cells or mucus or small amounts of digestive enzymes. I guess, what are all these other things that are in there that haven't been broken down, haven't been digested, and so forth. So it's a pretty complex material that we have coming out. The color of the fecal pellet is due primarily to breakdown products from the bile pigments. So the bile salts and bile pigments that we have going through, and those kind of go back to red blood cells, breakdown of red blood cells. So we've got some breakdown products of hemoglobin that wind up being put into the system along with the bile, and that's really, to a large part, what gives it that color. Without those pigments, then the fecal pellet would be much less colorful. Now, even though there's relatively little absorption that goes on in the large intestine, at least for the nutrients and so forth, it still turns out that the mucosa lining of the large intestine is a fairly absorptive surface for a variety of things. Things like anesthetics, sedatives, tranquilizers, steroids, things like that. And so those are all rapidly absorbed through the lining of the large intestine. And because of that, doctors will sometimes administer those kinds of things via an enema, especially if they're having problems getting them in other ways, administer them that way and get them absorbed that way. Water is absorbed really quickly. Now, there wasn't a whole lot of water coming through, right, because most of it was removed in the small intestine. But water's absorbed really, really quickly. And you have to be really careful, actually, if you're administering a water enema. I'll be with you a second, and there are various reasons for doing that. That water, if you give a big enough volume of it, it can be absorbed so quickly that you wind up with what's called water intoxication. A water intoxication is when you have more water going in, you exceed your body's ability to get rid of the water, the water's going in, and it causes swelling, various kinds of edema. In children, especially with certain conditions, water intoxication has caused their death. So just the absorption of water through the lining of the large intestine the water was being administered for various reasons. So water intoxication, extreme water intoxication, convulsions, coma, death, things like that because of the swelling of the body. One last little bit of information, and then we'll be done here, and that has to do with transit time. People always want to know, well, how long does material stay in the system? Okay, once you've eaten a meal, how long will it take before that meal, we start to see that meal on the other end? And believe it or not, there are people who have done experiments with this. What they do is they take some small inert pellets, really tiny things, and insert them in the food and then watch for them to come out. Okay, you can monitor them along the way. And it's been estimated that with a test meal like this that's got these things in it, the first part travels through the entire small intestine in about 4 hours, so that's how long it's being retained in the small intestine, with all of it entering the colon by 8 to 9 hours. So, you know, roughly 8 to 9 hours for keeping that food in the small intestine. It takes about 12 hours for it to move through the colon to the rectum, which is interesting. Small intestine is 20, 21 feet long. The colon is about 4 feet long, up, over, and down. And one of the another thing that they discovered was as much as 25% of a test meal is still in the rectum after 72 hours, with total recovery, hallelujah, taking about a week. So if you really need to impress your friends now with some statistics, especially sitting over lunch, you've got the numbers, and you can go and do that with. Okay, so have a great weekend. Hope you have a profitable Martin Luther King holiday. See you all Tuesday.